Since you aligned yourself with the Komizar, you'll face Venden judgment. My sister has a court waiting for you. The captain stared back, silent, maybe seeing the boy king he had betrayed, maybe retracing the choices he could have made. I saw death standing behind him, waiting to take him. Maybe not here, not today. Maybe on a windy turret in Venda justice would be served, when the watch captain's neck snapped and it was time to move on to his final judgment.
And who is this? The king asked, stepping in front of Jace.
The Patrey of Hell's Mouth, Jace answered, glaring at the king. And I demand to be released.
The king turned toward me.
And he's here because...
Tell him, Kazi, Jace said. Explain to him why I'm here and not home protecting my family and empire.
I swallowed, the answer trapped in my throat. Grizz stepped forward and answered before I could.
He gave the fugitive sanctuary and the supplies to build an arsenal of weapons.
Then he'll face a noose too.
Chapter 56. Jace.
Over and over again, as I had walked through the valley, I thought to myself, our weapons were not meant for this, never for this. I stared at Sarva, remembering when he tried to take the launcher from me, remembering all their promises. We'll have the cure soon. They had shown my father the ledgers of the ancients, the magic of cures and formulas we couldn't understand, but they promised that the scholars were deciphering them, and we bought it. The months were peppered with false breakthroughs and progress whenever our patience wore thin. Sarva and Beaufort both looked far too cocky, as if there was still a chance of escape. 20 Moragi's troops were escorting us back to Venda, not to mention the fellow named Grizz, who was 3 men and 1. There was bad blood between him and the Vendans, and he would never let them out of his sight. There'd be no slipping away, though it was still on my mind. I had to get home. Whatever league was trying to displace us, it wouldn't be long before they regrouped and came after us again. Had Beaufort been conspiring with one of them? It seemed unlikely. He'd been holed up at Tor's watch for almost a year with no outside contact, except for Zane. He was Beaufort's lone contact with the outside world. Somewhere deep down, I had known they couldn't be trusted. My father knew. That's why he had sent a letter to the king's magistrate. Yet in spite of the vague reply, he still let them into Tor's watch. I'm sorry. There never was a fever cure. He knew what would make you listen. How? How did an on-the-run fugitive know about my sister and brother? Sylvie and Micah died 4 years ago. Years before Beaufort arrived at Tor's watch. It wasn't news anymore. Somehow he'd done his research. He found the chink in our armor, the one thing that would open the door to Tor's watch and the Ballinger purse. A wound that still wept. I had been first among my father's sons to agree to it. The guilt of Sylvie had stayed with me, including the things I did after she died. I'd been haunted by her pleas, her fear of being trapped in a cold, dark tomb, the simple promise I wouldn't give her in her last moments. 2 days after her funeral, I stole her body. I did the unthinkable and desecrated her tomb in the middle of the night. No one ever knew. Everyone thought I had disappeared from grief, but I had taken her wrapped body high into the Moro Mountains and buried it in the most beautiful place I could find. The kind of place she would love. At the base of Breida's Tears, just below the 7th waterfall where ferns and flowers bloomed, where the sun shone in the day and the moon glowed at night. I marked it with a single stone, and the tears that wet it were not Breida's, but my own. Beaufort's false promise had hit its mark with resounding accuracy. It sickened me how well he had strung us along, how perfectly he explained one delay after another, how the others had backed him up. How humble and earnest they had all been. Until the end. When they were close to getting what they wanted, their arrogance started showing. I looked over at them, sitting together, eating their dinner. The rage in me rose. We were forced to eat with our hands shackled, a trencher of bread and meat only, no plates, no utensils, nothing that might be used as a weapon against one another. Our keepers didn't want any more prisoners dying en route. What had they all been trying to keep Phineas from saying? The few words he said were only babble. Stars? The Tembris showing him? He'd been shaken by the staggering death and destruction in the valley. I had been too. But something else aided him. It was just a spring picnic compared to what they had planned. What was it they had planned? Cassie had mentioned domination of the kingdoms. What had seemed ludicrous when she first told me didn't seem implausible now. I'm guessing they planned to kill your whole family once you gave them everything they needed. I eyed Sarva, shoving the last of his dinner into his mouth. You can't take that. He had tried to stop me from taking the launcher because he didn't want me to be armed. Why? Because I might be able to stop him from killing my family? After seeing a whole valley swollen with dead, I knew one family was nothing to him. He licked his fingers and looked up at me. A smirk crossed his lip. Fool. And that was all it took. I flew across the expanse, grabbed him with both shackled hands, and threw him across the clearing. He tumbled over the dirt, jumped to his feet, and I came at him again, both chained hands swinging into his gut, doubling him over. I heard the yelling, someone saying, "Let them fight." I doubted anyone could have stopped us. He returned my blows, his shackles not diminishing the impact of his fists as they slammed into my stomach. Another powerful strike to my shoulder knocked me to the ground, but it was the words he hissed between blows when our grips strained against each other, mocking my father, my family, the things he would do to them, that blinded me with fury. I couldn't believe we'd let this monster into our home. I jammed my elbow into his side, my forearm into his face, and when he stumbled to the side, I swooped my chained hands over his head, pulling the chain tight against his neck. He choked and gasped, his fingers struggling to pull it away. Now let me tell you what I'm going to do to you, Sarva. I felt a sword at my back. That's enough, Patre. He'll die by Venden justice, not yours. Eben ordered me to let him go. I hesitated and he pushed the sword harder. Now! I loosened my hold, slipping the chain free, and Sarva dropped to the ground, gasping for air. I looked over at Beaufort with a clear message. You're next, before a guard hauled me away. The lost horses streaked across the sky in their endless quest to find their mistress. Usually spotting them made me think of loyalty and determination, but now they only filled me with a sense of futility, a quest that would never be realized. It made me think of my father and his deathbed wish. Make her come. I should appreciate the irony. I was going to meet the queen, but not in the way he had envisioned. They had chained me over on the far side of camp, away from Sarva and the others, this time with my leg to the trunk of a fallen tree to make sure I didn't go anywhere. Natia had come by and bandaged a cut on my arm where Sarva's shackles had slashed it. I sat on the trunk, picking at the frayed edges of the bandage, looking up at the heavens, wondering if the gods were looking back. It began with the stars. Phineas's words were the same ones Grace and Ballinger had written in our histories. Everything began with the stars. Even... I tried to get it out of my head, but I couldn't. Cassie and I began with the stars. On a ledge in the middle of nowhere, we counted the stars together and then we kissed. We became part of something as endless as a night sky, and I had believed it could be just as lasting. Even when I discovered her betrayal, some small part of me still held hope. She had loved me, I was certain, even if she wouldn't say it. I wanted to believe there was an explanation, that what we had could somehow be salvaged. I still wasn't ready to let go. But our end was as clear as our beginning, the moment she saw Zane. It was the final blow. When she had looked from Zane to me, the look in her eyes, it wasn't hatred. I watched something in her die. Us. I gave the ring back to you when it mattered. She would never believe another word I said. Truth that came too late was as useful as a meal to a dead man. Looks like I can't step away for 1 minute. Getting into more trouble, I hear. I startled at her voice, but kept my eyes fixed on the horizon. Cassie stood somewhere close behind me. I didn't answer, hoping her curiosity was satisfied and she'd go away. I couldn't trust myself around her. My silence didn't sway her. I was in the king's tent, she explained. I was having dinner with him, so I didn't hear the ruckus. Dinner with the king? You're moving up in the world. To think, just a few nights ago, you were having dinner with the likes of me. I heard the bitter implication that I cared and immediately regretted it. I'm sorry. I'm angry about a lot of things, but not that you had dinner with the king. She stepped over the log and stood in front of me, so I had to look at her. Emotions battled inside me. Anger, resentment, guilt, and surprisingly, desire. I fought an impulse to pull her into my arms, to press my lips to hers, whisper in her ear, to make the last few days disappear, to explain things that should have been explained long ago, to tell her about Zane when I knew it would only make her hate me more, because after everything she had been through, it was a truth she deserved. But those same thoughts spun with others, and anger pounded in my temples that I was here at all, that she had whittled her way into my life and Tor's watch under false pretenses, that she had strung me along on a grand scale. Her gaze was as warm as frost. "What are you angry about?" she asked. I laughed. "Really? It's not obvious?" I rattled the chain on my leg. "I've been deceived by just about everyone I trusted or counted on, right down to the cook I hired." I stood, so I was looking down at her now. "The cook I hired for you." The words were meant to stab her, but instead they stabbed me. She never promised me tomorrows, and now I knew why. She blinked at last, the frost splintering. Emotion rushed through me again that I couldn't trust. "You should go." She didn't move. "What's the fever cure?" she asked. "Another thing that never existed. Please, Cassie, I need you to leave." I heard Phineas say he knew it would make you listen. What did he mean? I sighed and sat back on the log. My brother and sister that I told you about? Micah and Sylvie? I cleared my throat. They died from a fever. Beaufort figured it out. He found a weak spot in my family and used it to wheedle his way into our good graces. He claimed he had a cure. That was all he needed to say to make my mother invite him in. And my father. I looked at her sharply. Yes, we wanted the weapons too. Yes, we gave him the supplies. Yes, we looked the other way to get what we wanted. Is that what you wanted to hear? We knew he was trouble, even if we didn't know exactly what kind. I raked my hands through my hair, still wishing she'd leave. Instead, she sat down beside me. No, that's not what I wanted to hear, she said quietly. I leaned forward and shook my head. Why didn't you just tell me about Beaufort when you first came? We didn't know for sure if he was even there, and if he was there, it was obvious it was with the Ballinger welcome. If I had told you, what would you have done, Jace? Be honest. Alerted him? Questioned him so he could disappear again? Denied it? Isn't that exactly what you did when I spotted him outside Dark Cottage? You claimed he was a groundsman. You lied to me and hid who he was. You saw the devastation today, and now you know their crimes even beyond that valley. These men deserve to be held accountable. I made a vow to the queen and to the gods that I would bring the captain back. I couldn't risk losing him by telling you. We were not going to use our weapons for that, I said, motioning in the direction of the valley. If you ever knew me at all, you know that much. She nodded. It's in the hands of the queen now. It was late. The camp was asleep except for the soldiers on watch and Kazi. I had seen her pacing, watching the other prisoners as if she entrusted their care to no one else. I made a vow to the queen and to the gods. We may have grown up differently, but there were many ways that Kazi and I were alike. She finally rested, propping herself up against a thin, leafless tree, but still staring into the darkness. You asked me why an open world frightens me, Jace? Because it gives me nowhere to hide. I thought of all the stories I had told her when we were chained together in the wilderness, the stories I could tell her now to help her fall asleep. I thought of the riddle I had promised her, the one that still circled through my head, the one I could never tell her now. I rolled over so I wouldn't have to look at her and tried to remember that I wasn't supposed to care.
Chapter 57. Kazi.
And sometimes she likes to snip the eyelids away first, so you have to look at her. It depends on her mood. I walked away as Sanove concocted yet another punishment, describing it in gruesome detail to torture Bar and the other prisoners. Mostly Bar. These past weeks, she always managed to dip into a deeper well of creativity, making sure he was within earshot of her as she wondered aloud about the punishments the queen would dole out. I saw it wear on him. He no longer cursed her, but listened in grim silence. Mija and the other horses stood in the middle of Missoula Creek, drinking and cooling themselves. The sun was high and hot, the last days of summer taking a final bow. The break was a welcome respite. Even with troops to relieve us, I had rarely stepped away from the prisoners, always keeping my eye on them, wary that they would vanish before I could deliver them to the queen. The captain had a slippery history, but this wide, barren valley of sandstone and high cliffs was almost a prison in itself. He'd be going nowhere here. I stopped at a sparkling shallow where fool's gold glittered through the clear water, and I bent down to splash my face. The caravan was strewn out along the banks of the creek, but my attention settled on Jace. His hands were unshackled for the rest stop, and he was rinsing out his shirt. He'd gotten into another fight, this time with both Sarva and Bar. They had said something to set him off, but he didn't say what it was. It was Sanove who broke up the fight, saying she wanted to make sure Bar lasted long enough to face the justice he deserved. Jace had gotten a bloody nose out of the skirmish and had used his shirt to wipe his face. As he washed it, I noticed a group of soldiers looking at his tattoo, probably wondering at its significance, but certainly not understanding the story behind it. Not understanding the reasons he got it when he was only 15, not understanding anything about the man who wore it, just as I hadn't the first time I had seen it. I found myself wanting to tell them about the long history of Tor's Watch, the recent settlement that Jace had helped build, the sluice, the root cellar, the small Venden boy he taught to dig post holes. I wanted to tell them about the ongoing power wars that threatened Jace's home, the town he kept safe, the secret enemies who battled to take it, the family who had clothed me and welcomed me to their table. Jace was more than just a prisoner they looked at with curiosity. He was a patre, and that symbol tattooed across his chest was a promise, centuries of promises to protect. It was in his blood. His world was not our world. But I had wanted it to be. Now, with our days together coming to an end, I realized that with everything that I knew about him, there was still so much more I didn't know, or hadn't bothered to know. Like Sylvie, I'd heard Jace's voice crack when he said her name. I was going to tell you. I swear I was. Sometimes it seemed the timing of the entire world was off.
our intentions coming too soon or too late, life crowding up to blur our vision, and only later, when the dust settles, can we see our missteps. I could have given him that ring sooner. I could have saved him the worry. But there were questions I had wanted to avoid, just as he had wanted to avoid mine.
Stop staring and enjoy the break while you can, Ren said. I hadn't heard her walk up behind me.
Someone still with them? I asked, craning my neck to look through soldiers and horses for Beaufort and the others.
Ren knew that by someone, I meant one of us. It wasn't that I didn't trust the Moragese soldiers, but I trusted us more. We were too close now to take any chances. I'd had to choose between Zane and these men. I wasn't about to lose them too. Relax. Eben and Sinove are with them.
I looked back at Jace. After two fights, we now kept him separated from the other prisoners.
You have to stop beating yourself up, Kazi, Ren said. You gave him a chance to step aside, and according to Grizz, it was an undeserved chance.
I know how it looks to Grizz, but the bare facts don't always tell the whole truth. I didn't give him any chance. A Ballinger never steps aside. They hold their ground. They protect what's theirs at all costs. And I knew that.
Ren shook her head. It's that stubborn pride of theirs.
It's more than that. It's their history. It's who they are. We sat down together on the bank and cooled our feet in the water. I'm still worried about what Barr said to Phineas.
That there's still time.
I nodded. We had interrogated every prisoner individually, but none would say a word, not even with the hope of a deal to spare their lives, as if some other hope was still out there. It's as if they're expecting a rescue, and if they are, that means they weren't working alone.
He might have meant there was still a chance for them to escape. They've done it before.
Possibly. I had seen them watching for opportunities, eyeing weapons and stands of forests to disappear into. But there was one other thing. When the captain first saw troops riding toward us, his face brightened, as if he thought they were somebody else. Ren thought for a moment.
It could be they were working with a league. Paxton, maybe?
Yes, or one of the others.
Or, worst-case scenario, several of them together. I remembered Rybart and Truco walking the streets together back in Hell's Mouth. Even if they were working with a league to take down the Ballingers, the important thing is, by their own words, they didn't have an arsenal yet. We got there in time and destroyed their plans. We saw them go up in flames. Plus, we have the architects for those weapons in custody. Whatever plans they had are finished. Life will go on as usual at Tor's Watch.
I thought about the captain's reaction when we destroyed the plans, the piles of documents that were his key to riches. His fury at their loss was real. The same with Torbak, all his work up in flames. I was certain by their reactions that they were all burned. But then what were the papers that Phineas wanted me to destroy? He had mentioned olives in his last breaths, too.
Olives?
Maybe as he struggled with his last words, he became confused. Maybe he meant the papers I had already destroyed.
Break's over, Grizz called. Let's move out.
Ren dipped her handkerchief into the water and tied it in a cooling band around her head.
I better get back before Sinove starts in on another gruesome end. We'll never get her moving.
But neither of us begrudged any fear she wanted to inflict. Barr had earned it. Sinove and many others would have to live with the fear Barr had inflicted on them for the rest of their lives. With the call to move out, soldiers began putting their boots back on and saddling horses. Jace wrung out his shirt and slung the twisted fabric over his shoulder. He sloshed back along the creek's edge with his boots in hand. His horse was tethered in the creek near mine. The axle on the wagon had broken more than a week ago, and we'd been forced to switch the prisoners to horses. While we made faster progress, it made for a tenser ride. Even with their hands tied in front of them and two horses tethered together, we had to keep a constant watch on our captives. I waited at the bank's edge until he caught up, my toes nervously curling into the sand. It had been days since we had really spoken. The last time I tried to talk to him, he had asked me to leave. He didn't want to speak to me. I understood that. He stopped in front of me.
"I get an escort back to my horse?"
he asked. I looked at his bare chest, the sweep of the tattooed wing seeming to wave me away now. I was an outsider again. I remembered when my fingernail used to outline the jagged edge of the feathers. "You should put your shirt back on so your back doesn't burn." He stood ankle deep in the water, not moving, his shirt still dripping from his shoulder, the tilt of his head full of irritation.
"What's really on your mind, Cassie?"
He reminded me of how he had looked that day on the riverbank after we had escaped from the labor hunters. Then, he'd looked like he was ready to bash in my head, and I'd thought the chain was the only thing saving me. That seemed like years ago. He shifted weight, signaling his impatience. "I was talking with Ren and Sinove this morning," I said. "They're afraid that your family will retaliate against the settlement. It's my worry, too. Will they?"
"And incur the further wrath of the Venden Queen? You don't need to worry."
He started to walk on. "Jace," he spun around.
"I made a blood vow to protect them, Cassie. And the Patre's vow is his family's vow. We don't go back on our word. Call it that Ballinger pride you like to make fun of. Anything else?"
His expression was strained, as if he couldn't stand to be next to me. I thought there was nothing left inside of me to crumble, but I was wrong. His contempt was more than I could bear. "No, nothing." I began to step away when he lunged, pulling me with him as we tumbled to the ground. I didn't have time to yell or react. He hovered over me, his chest pounding against mine, his expression impossible to discern.
"A scorpion," he explained. "You almost stepped on it."
He looked at me for a second longer, and I wondered if he was thinking the same thing as me. What happened to us? How did we get here? But the answer was clear. Once again, we'd been shoved down an unexpected path, and there was no clawing our way back to the one we'd been on. A simple chain we had both cursed had done the unthinkable. It forced us to see the world through each other's eyes. Now we had to forget those worlds. Or maybe we would always be haunted by the memory of each other. His grip on my arms tightened for a moment, a breath shuddering in his chest. But then he released me and stood. He grabbed one of his fallen boots, then smashed it down.
"It's dead. You should put your boots back on."
I got up and looked at the broken scorpion, a black ringtail. Its venom could kill you in seconds. I watched Jace walk away, uncertain if even he knew how strongly protection ran in his blood. When we got back to where our horses were tethered, there was a commotion. Barr had mounted his horse before his hands were chained or the horse's lead was tied to another. While some soldiers had their arrows drawn and were ordering him off his horse, Sinove screamed above them.
"Stand down! I have this! I said stand down!"
Grizz motioned to the soldiers and they lowered their weapons. He knew Sinove's archery skills, that she could easily take Barr down on her own. But she didn't. She was doing the opposite, taunting him to run like she had before. His eyes were crazed and his lips twisted. Maybe Sinove's stories were finally getting the best of him. "Don't worry," she told him. "You have my word. I won't put an arrow through your skull."
"But you're a coward, Barr. A sniveling, weak coward who hides behind the sword.
I bet you wouldn't make it a day out there alone. You'll save us the waste of a good rope if you run.
Here, I'll even help you out.
She tossed him her water skin, and he slung it over his shoulder.
Go,
she ordered.
Go!
He stared at her, uncertain what to do, freedom at his fingertips. His knuckles were white, gripping the reins.
I won't kill you,
Sinove said softly.
I promise.
Grizz's eyes were tight beads. He looked at Sinove like she had lost her mind. The whole camp was quiet, waiting, every breath held. And then Bar ran. He turned his horse and lit out as if demons chased behind him. Grizz glared at Sinove.
Do something or I will.
Sinove smiled. She walked over to her quiver of arrows and pulled out a blunt. Her movements were slow, smooth, calculated. Her chin lifted, her head turning, assessing the light wind. Bar was getting farther and farther away. A blunt would not stop him. She studied the horizon, waiting, adjusting the pristine glove the queen had given her. Then she knocked the arrow. She lifted her bow and slowly pulled back, poised and calm as if she had choreographed every breath and breeze. Seconds passed, and she finally let the arrow fly. What was she doing? It would not kill him. At this distance, it likely wouldn't even stun him. He was at least 200 yards away now. I lost sight of the arrow in the bright sky, but then suddenly the water skin on Bar's back exploded with a dark liquid.
What the devil is that?
Grizz yelled. A chill ran down my back as Sinove grinned. I knew.
Blood,
she answered. Rich, ripe antelope blood. It was only seconds before a dark cloud swooped across the horizon. It skimmed the parched valley floor like a winged rider heading toward us, toward Bar, who still raced ahead. It happened fast.
He was snatched up in its claws, and in seconds it was flying over us.
Bar writhing in its grip, screaming, and then, just as fast, they were both gone, the whoosh of the Rakaz wings drowning out the last of his screams. Sinove's eyes narrowed, a grin still on her lips.
I guess I was wrong.
He's not alone out there after all.
Chapter 58. Jace.
I couldn't say I wasn't glad to see Bar depart, but afterward it made me think that if the queen had half the creative fury of Sinove, I was in big trouble. But the queen was supposedly bedridden, so there was at least that. I had to look for whatever bright spots I could. I wondered why she was confined to her bed. Had she been injured in the Great War? Rumor was that she was strong and had managed to bring down the 12-foot half-god Komizar. Maybe, like her brother, she had an injury she had never recovered from. Grizz had strong words with Sinove after Bar's departure, and she took them stoically. Apparently she had broken some rule of theirs, or maybe Grizz just didn't want to arrive at the queen's doorstep empty-handed, with every prisoner snatched from his grip. Two were already dead. I noted the other prisoners had gone silent, maybe trying to avoid drawing Sinove's attention. Last night at dinner, the only sound I heard out of them was a burp. In some ways, I was sorry that Grizz had reprimanded her. I wouldn't have minded if she pulled that stunt at least one more time. On Beaufort. Last night when we set camp, I had watched Cassie studying Sinove, and I had wondered what she was thinking. Was she wishing she could see Zane suffer the way Bar had? But that chance was gone. For 11 years, she had looked for him, and I had kept him out of her grasp. The right moment to tell her had never come. Cassie told me this morning we weren't going to Venda, but to a place called Marabella. We'd be there today. I thought I'd have more time. I was caught off guard, and maybe that was the point, to keep the prisoners in the dark. I was sure the others still didn't know. She said Marabella was a former Dalbrecht outpost that had been converted and expanded to serve as a place of mutual rule for two kingdoms. When the Dalbrecht king and the Venden queen married, they divided their time between the two kingdoms and also the outpost halfway between them. Cassie was riding up ahead with Ren, Sinove, Eben, and Natia, surrounding the other prisoners. They guarded them like they were gold. I had seen the strain in her face this morning when she saddled Mija, as if she might lose them in these last hours. Ruins had become more plentiful as we traveled, and maybe that's what contributed to the tension. There were more places for bandits to hide. I was left to ride at the end of our caravan with Grizz on one side of me and a Moragese soldier on the other. If I were picked off by bandits, I supposed it wouldn't matter as much. As we rode over a rise in the landscape, someone called, "There it is!" It was still a long way off, but I caught my first glimpse of Marabella. Its high, white walls gleamed in the distance, and a city sprawled around it. Natia had told me it was the first site designated as a settlement. I guessed there was less than an hour before we reached it. "I need to speak to Cassie," I said. Grizz snorted, disinterested in my requests. "Nah. It's important." He squinted an eye.
"About what?"
"It's between me and her, you bastard. Go get her." His eyes sparked and his fingers twitched, and I knew I was about to get a mouthful of knuckles from a man three times my size, and I added, "Please." Cassie rode back, her face shining with sweat, a tense crease between her brows. "What is it?" she asked. "I need to stay with the other prisoners. They're jumpy." So was she. She looked at me, waiting, impatient, and I realized what I had to say didn't really matter anymore. "Jace," she said, trying to hurry me along. I blurted something else out instead. "Will I get a chance to speak?" "Yes," she answered. "When you stand before the queen to answer to the charges, she'll hear you out." "At her bedside? Is she dying?" "What?" "You said she was unable to travel and was confined to her bed. I thought that maybe—" "No, it's nothing like that. Her physician ordered no travel. She miscarried her first child, and now she's expecting again."
Chapter 59. Cassie.
Scouts had ridden ahead of us, so long before we arrived, the news had spread. By the time we neared the gates of Marabella, large crowds had gathered. Soldiers lined our path to keep everyone back, but mostly the crowd was still and surprisingly silent. A deathly pall had fallen as if ghosts rode at our sides. These were not prisoners they ever expected to see. Mouths hung open. Eyes glistened. A man as big as Grizz wept. They may not have recognized Beaufort and Torbak, but they knew Governor Sarva and Chiavdar Cardos. I watched the stunned faces fill with terror and then hatred. No doubt many had experienced loss at these men's hands or knew someone who had. Sarva and Cardos looked straight ahead, refusing to meet their gazes. Beaufort began looking around, his head craning back nervously. "Still expecting a rescue?" I asked. He looked at me, and that was when I saw real terror. He'd never expected to face the queen again, at least not on her terms. He had thought his patience would pay off once more, and he would never meet his fate. "It's over, Captain. No one is coming for you. This is the end of the line." His face contorted as if struggling with this truth, and finally his lip lifted in a snarl as he scrutinized me. He shook his head with disgust.
By worthless street trash. By a crap cake like you.
That's right. By someone like me. A drop of sweat trickled over his half-moon scar.
It will never be over. Not now. A door has been unlocked. More like me will always come.
Maybe so. But more like me will always be there to stop them. He looked over his shoulder one last time, as if still hopeful, but all he saw were the Venden crowds closing in, erasing the path behind him. I clutched the jail log in my hand. As lead on the mission, it was my job to present it to the Queen. The names of the prisoners we had delivered into the warden's custody. She would address the prisoners later. I sat on a stone bench outside her personal chamber, waiting, my knee bouncing. I fingered the wish stock in my pocket that I had bought from a merchant just outside the outpost walls. A servant opened the door, and I jumped to my feet. "The Queen will see you now," she said. I was escorted in, and the servant left. The room was cool and dim. The sweet fragrance of roses hung in the air. With the curtains drawn, I didn't see her at first. "Kazi Myra," she said softly, walking toward me. She was in a dressing gown and her hair was loose around her shoulders. I dropped to a knee.
"Your Majesty."
"Enough of that." She lightly touched my arm so I would stand, then drew me into her arms. She hugged me tightly, as if she'd been worried. And I found myself hugging her back, holding her in a way I had never done before. My breaths uneven, my throat stabbing, and somewhere deep within I felt a tug, like a stitch pulling tight, and I imagined its color to be silver. "Welcome home," she whispered. When she drew away, I noticed her belly. The large round bump was gone and my heart jumped. She must have seen the fear on my face.
"No, everything's fine. Come."
She guided me to a cradle beside her bed. My chest swelled.
"She? He is beautiful."
The Queen smiled.
"She. I can't stop looking at her. I watch every twitch, every smile, every pout of her lip."
She leaned over and scooped the sleeping baby into her arms, kissing her forehead, then touching her tiny fingers, wonder filling her face.
"Have you named her?" I asked.
She nodded and her eyes glistened.
"Aster," she answered. "I named her Aster, the saving angel."
She kissed the baby again and gently laid her back in the cradle. "And you have made her world safer, Kazi Myra. I am indebted to you and your team. A thank you is not nearly enough." My throat squeezed.
"I am honored to serve, Your Majesty.
Will you ever call me Leah?" "Grizz doesn't approve." She shook her head.
"Come," she said. "Tell me about your journey."
We sat on the settee beneath the window, and she poured us each a goblet of water. I presented her with the prison log, but she wanted to hear about the prisoners from me. She had already heard we had come back with more than we set out for. First, I told her about the prisoners who had died en route, then Torback, and then I told her about the captain. She let out a slow breath, and I saw the relief in her face that he was finally captured. But there was also turmoil in her eyes, as if she revisited the pain he had wrought, not just upon Morrigan and Venda, but upon her family. She said she wished her father had lived long enough to see this day. When I told her about Governor Sarva and Chievdar Cardos, she shook her head in disbelief, shocked that they were still alive. She had known them when she was held prisoner in the sanctum and remembered their cruel, vindictive ways. "Captain Alarion still thinks he's going to get away," I warned. "That doesn't surprise me,"
But there's no chance of that now, she said. He murdered Captain Azia, one of my husband's best officers. Rafe will probably guard Alarion himself until he sees him hanging from a rope. She assured me that all the prisoners would remain under heavy guard while they awaited trial. There's one other prisoner I need to tell you about, I said. I dug my nails into my palms, trying to force the wobble from my throat. This one may take a while. The queen's brows rose with interest, and she sat back on the settee, curling her feet beneath her. I'm listening.
Some said it began with the stars. They brought a magic the world could not contain. No, my grandfather said. It began with the anger of men. However it began, we are the end. I was 5 when the first star struck. I have no memory of my family, only my grandfather, one of the most powerful men in the world, the leader of a once great nation, scooping me into his arms and running. Running is all I remember. Years of running. I will never run again. Grayson Ballinger, 16. Chapter 60, Jace.
By the time I got to the receiving hall, I was seething. I'd been thrown in a cell and handed a bucket, and my inquiries of when I would see the queen were met with silence. Not a word. An hour of waiting and pacing passed, and then 3. Sunlight shifting through the tiny window of my cell. I could be here for days, weeks. I knew the game she played. I had played it with prisoners plenty of times. Let them wait and fear the worst. Maybe her tactic was working. Cassie said the queen would hear me out, but when? And even then, would she really listen? As far as the kingdoms were concerned, Tor's watch was nothing but a minor speck on the landscape. All they knew about us was what the king of Islandia had told them. And he knew nothing. I was through upholding the terms of Paxton's idiot great-grandfather, a whole town for a round of drinks. If I ever got out of here, I was taking back Hell's Mouth. We would no longer be held hostage to a gambling debt or defer to a king who had no interest in the town that he didn't bother to support. We would no longer be ignored. I felt like the voice raging in my head was my father's. After at least 4 hours, I was dragged out of my cell by 2 burly guards who again had nothing to say to me other than, shut up. They hauled me through the outpost and threw me into an empty hall to await the queen, my hands still tied behind me. But she wasn't there. 20 minutes passed, then 40. Silence ticked by. More waiting? The elevated end of the room had 2 passageways on either side. I waited for someone to come, but no one did. Where's the queen? I finally yelled. No answer. I let loose with a litany of shouts demanding that someone come. I heard a baby cry in the distance and then footsteps. Loud, angry footsteps. The crying stopped, but a man burst through one of the passageways, his burning blue eyes landing on me. He stomped down the steps and crossed the room, grabbing my shirt, nearly jerking me off my feet. He held me close, so we were eye to eye. The queen will get here when she gets here, but if you wake my baby daughter one more time, I'll pop your head from your shoulders. Understand? Who are you? I asked. A man who has had very little sleep in the past 48 hours, but to you, I am King Jackson. The king of Dalbrek. I'd also heard rumors about him, another 12-foot legend, one with a temper. Right now, he looked like an exhausted, crazed man, and a protective one. He let go of my shirt with a shove. And then I heard a shuffle. We both turned. 4 soldiers filed out of the right passageway. Dalbrech officers by the look of their uniforms, and then just behind them more officers. But these were Vendon. Grizz was one of them. They lined up on the dais facing me, long swords at their sides, and I wondered if this was going to be an impromptu execution. There was another shuffle of movement, this one quieter, and from the opposite passageway a woman walked out onto the dais. She held a baby in her arms. The king forgot about me and walked up the steps to meet her. His face was transformed as he looked at her, his rage replaced with tenderness. She looked at him in the same way. They gazed down together at the baby in her arms, and the king kissed the queen, long and leisurely, as if I wasn't there. This was Queen Jezalia of Venda, the one who held my fate in her hands. She was younger than I thought she'd be, and softer and more serene than I'd expected. Maybe this wouldn't be so difficult after all. She handed the baby to the king, and he held his daughter in the crook of his arm, his knuckle rubbing her cheek. The queen turned to me, and in an instant her softness vanished. The dreamy eyes she had for her baby and the king had turned hard and cutting. This was a monarch who tolerated no nonsense. She stepped to the end of the dais, confident in her stride, one brow arched in irritation. "So, you're the one making all the noise." "I'm the Patrey of Tor's Watch, and I demand correction," she said, briskly cutting me off. "You're my prisoner, and..." "What do you want me to do, bow? Because I won't do that. My realm was centuries old before the first stone was laid in yours, because..." She put her hand up in a swift stop motion and shook her head. "You're going to be trouble, aren't you?" "I was told I would get a chance to speak." "You will. But I get to go first, because I'm the queen. I just went through 20 hours of labor, and I'm the one wearing a sword." She wasn't wearing a sword, but I got her point. She may as well have been. "I was told you're a good listener, but maybe my source is wrong." "A good listener." "Casimira, is this the prisoner you told me about?"
I startled as Cassie walked out of the passageway. Her steps were smooth and composed. She turned to face me, her expression grim, but her eyes only looked into mine briefly before she looked away again.
"Yes, Your Majesty. It's him."
The queen turned back to me.
"Then I expect you to listen, Patrey, because my Ratan are never wrong."
I boiled inside like an overheated kettle, but I remained silent, waiting for my chance to speak. She had a guard untie my hands, then repeated the charges against me, violating kingdom treaties by harboring fugitives, in addition to conspiring to dominate the kingdoms. I opened my mouth to respond, and she shut me down with a quick glare and tilt of her head.
"However, as Casimira pointed out to me, you have not signed a treaty with the Alliance of Kingdoms because you are not a kingdom at all. Nor are you even part of Islandia. And yet you are steward of Hell's Mouth, which is part of that kingdom, which is all a very curious and complicated arrangement." "I don't like complications." Casimira explained to me how that came to pass.
She shook her head.
"A word of advice, Patrey. Never play cards with a monarch. They cheat."
The soldiers behind her rumbled in agreement, and the king grinned.
"In addition, she has also made me aware that the king of Islandia may have not acted in good faith, nor held up the tenets of the alliance in finding suitable land for a settlement, and in fact, may have intentionally chosen your land as a way to provoke you. This does not sit well with me. Using my citizens to settle grudges is not something I take kindly to. They have already been through untold hardships, and I will not suffer fools who bring them more. Nevertheless, I understand you rectified the situation by rebuilding the settlement at your own expense in a better location, and that you were very generous in the process."
I glanced at Cassie. She stood to the side of the queen, looking straight ahead, avoiding eye contact with me. The queen walked down the steps, studying me. I wondered if I was ever going to get a chance to speak, but my gut told me to wait, because none of this was going quite how I expected it to. I was wary, uncertain if I was being led to a cliff, and any minute I would be pushed over it.
"Still, you conspired to build weapons," she continued, "providing the fugitives with materials that could have brought great destruction upon the kingdoms. But my Ratan tells me the Watch Captain deceived you and his purposes were not your purposes. That you only wanted to protect your interests against aggressors. Should I believe her?
I started to answer, but she shut me down again.
It was rhetorical. I always believe and trust the judgment of my Ratan. It's you I'm still leery of.
She pursed her lips.
But Captain Ellarion is an accomplished liar, and in fact, even my father and I were greatly deceived by him.
She walked in a circle around the room, as if thinking. I looked at Cassie, whose eyes were on me now, her pupils tight beads. The king's eyes drilled into me, too. Something about this was all wrong. I felt like a lone fish in a barrel, and everyone else in the room had a spear. The queen stopped circling and faced me again.
I've also been enlightened about your family's long history, perhaps longest of any of the kingdoms. Casimira says you claim to be descended from the leader of the ancients, the first family, and she's seen some evidence of it herself.
It's not a claim, it's the truth, I said, not waiting for an invitation to speak.
Tell me something about it, then. I want to hear it in your own words.
The Ballinger history? I asked.
Yes.
I hesitated, still uncertain where this was going, wondering just what Cassie had told the queen, because it seemed she had said a lot. The queen waited for my answer. All right, I answered slowly. This wasn't what I thought I'd be speaking about. I started at the beginning with Aaron Ballinger, the chief commander of the Ancients. He was forced to run, like everyone else during the last days, when the seat of his command was destroyed. I explained about his struggle to survive, and his final effort to get a group of children to a faraway shelter, and then his murder by scavengers. Before he died, he passed the responsibility of leadership to his grandchild, Grayson. He was the eldest, but only 14. I told her how he and 22 other children struggled to survive in the Tor's Watch vault while predators waited outside. She listened intently, but she seemed to be studying me too, and I became self-conscious of every move I made. They finally learned to defend themselves and eventually ventured out to lay the first stones of Tor's Watch, and that was the first generation. We have centuries of history after that.
That's quite impressive, she answered. I have a keen interest in history. I've discovered that there are several histories on this continent, and I've learned something from them all. But yours is especially intriguing. It seems that perhaps all the kingdoms have been remiss in failing to acknowledge the place of Tor's Watch on the continent, however small it might be.
She tapped her lips, her gaze dissecting me, long seconds passing, and then her chin lifted, like a seasoned trader at the arena ready to make a final offer.
Here's what I'd like to propose, Jace Ballinger. I'd like to suggest to the Alliance that they take Tor's Watch under consideration to be acknowledged and accepted as another kingdom on the continent. However, as Casimira says, your ways are not our ways, and that presents a few prickly problems.
She stated the things we would have to change in order for this to happen, and that included ending our blatant support of the black market trade.
It might be rampant across the continent, but it is still theft. And then there's the matter of your borders. You would have to establish clear ones.
I didn't respond, still thinking all this was some sort of trick.
You're not willing to do this, she asked.
What's the catch?
No catch. Some things are just the right thing to do. Casimira told me you understood that concept, and it would serve our interests, too, to have a reliable ally in that region.
There it was. I heard the implication that King Monty was incompetent. I couldn't disagree, though it seemed Cassie had embellished the story about him choosing the settlement site. I still wasn't convinced he knew it was our land. And it's that simple? Just like that, we're a recognized nation? No, the king replied, jiggling the stirring baby on his shoulder. It's not that simple at all. It could take months, even years, for all the kingdoms to agree, and it would include several investigative trips by ambassadors. But the queen is very persuasive, not to mention she has an inroad with the king of Dalbrek. The kingdoms will go along, eventually, providing you agree to the terms. 50 miles, I said. Those are our borders. 50 miles in all directions from Tor's Watch.
But that would include Hell's Mouth, the Queen noted.
That's right, I confirmed.